Welcome to the Inclusive Education Project. I'm Vicki Brett.
I'm Amanda Salohi. We're two civil rights lawyers on a mission to change the conversation about education, civil rights, and modern activism.
Each week, we're going to explore new topics which are going to educate and empower others
and give them a platform to enact change in education and level the playing field.
Welcome back, listeners. Some of you may have already had your last week of school, end of May, but we know that there are plenty of people that go well into the third week of June.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's us.
So, you know,
I go back and forth on, like, is it a good thing or a bad thing? Because to a certain extent, like, consistent schooling is good. Summer tends to be crazy, but, like, sometimes in a good way, sometimes wild. So I don't know if we're lucky or not.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, if they started the third week of September, like, a lot of the school districts, like we were talking about the other day, Amanda, were trying to align so that the AP kids, you know, don't have like 2 months of school where they're not doing anything. And we know that a lot of districts, especially here in California, are moving towards that. And so then it just means that, like, school starts August 12th or something, right? So with that, we kind of wanted to shift the focus back for a part two with Dr. Tan regarding the integrity of the assessments that we see when there is an English learner that is being assessed. So, Dr. Tan, we just kind of want to jump right into it with you. Welcome back. Thank you for coming back on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So where we kind of left off, we got into a couple of different topics in the realm of when we're having a child that English is their second language. And then before we started recording, we kind of got into the discussion about the integrity of the numbers, right? So once an evaluation is completed, what is the process for you in your private practice? Just so that parents have something to compare it to when the school district completes an assessment. So what happens when somebody comes to you and gets an assessment?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, my evaluations, I assess comprehensively across domains, across brain functions. And, you know, a lot of the decisions that we are making, either diagnostically or in terms of our conceptualization, is based on, you know, the scores that we get from our assessments. And so I actually always schedule a feedback session, either sometimes, you know, same day or, you know, just because sometimes I think parents are very anxiously awaiting the results.
Yeah.
I like to try to give them an idea of kind of what we looked at in the evaluation, what the main findings were, and to kind of prepare them for what they're going to see once they get the report. And so I always follow with a comprehensive report as well. And so just to talk to them about kind of the overall patterns, maybe explaining some of the different scores that were notable, kind of explaining, you know, why I'm going to give a certain diagnosis. And I find it's just very helpful to have that in-person conversation to help equip them with the knowledge and information and to give them the chance to ask all the questions they have about, you know, the assessment process. And so they can better understand once families are using those reports to help advocate in the school districts, et cetera, you know, they're equipped with the information of what everything actually means.
That's really helpful for parents because when we show up to an IEP meeting, so the district has completed the assessment, Amanda and I have talked about this ad nauseum, but we always try to get a copy of the draft assessment at least, you know, a week before the IEP meeting so that parents that were able to kind of read it beforehand and digest and or come prepared with questions, right? We don't need the school psychologist to read us the report. We need to be given a little bit more context. And it sounds like in the meetings that you have, that's your opportunity to kind of, yeah, explain a little bit of your reasoning, right? Even though it's technically there in the report, it's presented in a different way when it's a conversation, right? And I think that's what a lot of IEP teams miss is the conversational aspect of it. If you provide a copy of the draft of the IEP with the expectation that the parent is able to read it and digest it beforehand and or come prepared with questions, then you're able to kind of let loose and really have a conversation of like, now this is what it means. I think that a lot of times districts want to have a part one where it's like we read the assessment and a part two where we discuss the IEP placement and services. And I find that parents are way too anxious and they either kind of understand for the most part their child qualifies, but they want to know like the meat and potatoes, like how are you going to support my child? And I think that's probably what you see is missing from a lot of teams, right? Is like how they're that explanational component to parents, especially in the English language realm, right? Or English as a second language realm, where, you know, potentially a translator is used. Is there an impact for some of the testing that use or see where the evaluator is not speaking the primary language of the child?
Yeah, of course. You know, and I think this is where we start getting into, you mentioned this phrase earlier, the integrity of our tests and our test scores. You know, we really have to, you know, this last episode, part one, we talked about how do we provide these culturally and linguistically responsible evaluations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is the responsible administration of our tests and our awareness of where our tests come from, and importantly, how they were standardized and on what samples and normative data is based off of. And I find that, you know, in some of our more diverse groups, you know, if they're speaking a different language, these considerations start to fall out the window and we get these scores and
yeah.
we just interpret them the same way we would interpret any score, and then just, you know, maybe put an asterisk and say, oh, you know, this was given in an unstandardized way. But are we actually considering how that affects our interpretation, right? And so even at baseline, you know, most of our measures are, you know, developed primarily in the United States and are kind of very Western-based assessments. And so just at baseline, let's say we are just using an interpreter to translate kind of the instructions and maybe to administer items, you know, already we are deviating from the standardization, right? You're talking about a third party in the room. You're talking about, you know, kind of a method of administration that might not be as engaging of the child's attention. You're talking about, you know, these phrases and words that get lost in translation that might not mean the same thing. And so then you give this measure and then you kind of have these scores. And can we truly say that the numbers represent what they're supposed to mean? You know,
right.
That's not always a given. And there's a, you know, we can sometimes give our measures and use an interpreter. We can sometimes say, oh, look, this measure has been formally translated, right? There's many measures that do have translations, especially into Spanish. But what about the normative samples? You know, they may be translated, but the numbers might not be actually coming from a sample of people that represents the demographic of the.
Yeah. And then when you look at the analysis, like you were saying, we always have, like, on every assessment, there's always like a little asterisk or a little section that like assessors tend to skim by that says like, oh, these results are not affected by cultural or language deficits, da, 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 da. And I see those in a lot of these evaluations that are with an English learner. And I'm like, wait a minute, like we're just glossing over this. And it was interesting. I just did a training with a panel earlier this week, and we were talking about assessing and like identifying the need for assessment in early education, so like the preschool settings. And we had a speaker that was talking specifically about the like cultural implications. And she brought up a good point that I feel like assessment teams at school districts with young kiddos, like they don't think about. And what she said was like in her culture, in the Vietnamese culture, a lot of the emphasis is on the grandparents taking care of the kids. So she said like, while I work, my parents are taking care of my son, picking him up from school, doing the feeding. And in that culture, it's a lot of spoon feeding rather than having them use the utensils. And so when a child like that is evaluated for their fine motor skills or their feeding skills, the scores are going to be lower. And are we really taking that into consideration to say, is there a developmental delay or is it a cultural norm that we need to take into consideration? And then the same goes for like different cultures who place a lot of emphasis on independent skills versus others that, you know, focus a lot more on communication. And it's been very, very rare that I've seen an assessment team talk through this, like an analysis of, you know, what do these numbers actually say for this child based on these, all these other implications?
you mentioned, you know, there's so many different examples, right, of just how culture and language differences can come in and really impact the integrity. I mean, even very face value level, you mentioned the Vietnamese population, you know, the Vietnamese alphabet does not have all the same letters as the English alphabet. And there are measures that we use, right, to assess, you know, verbal fluency, phonemic fluency, you know, how many words can you generate that start with these letters? And some of those letters that we ask them are not actually present in the Vietnamese alphabet. And so it just, you know, even on very obvious levels, sometimes we just don't have, you know, the numbers, you know, might not actually be that valid, much less some of these more nuanced considerations. And we've had, you know, we're starting to see some progress in the field. There are now measures beyond just, you know, we're administering them with an interpreter, beyond just, oh, we're just translating it, even if it's formal translations. We now have measures that are starting to be adapted to other cultures and other populations and using samples for their normative data more accurate. You know, so for example, we have some measures now that are looking at English and Spanish language fluency, vocabulary, for example, and that were validated and their normative data taken from bilingual children in the United States, right? And so that's measure I'm going to use when I'm looking at a child that, you know, maybe English language learner, I'm trying to establish language dominance. That is the measure that I think is the most appropriate, as opposed to, you know, taking one of our typical measures and then just accepting answers in, you know, Spanish or, you know, having an interpreter translate. You know, it's just not the same integrity in terms of the data.
What have you kind of seen when, or this is like something that we've seen, let me take it back a second. So we'll have the numbers show up, right? And it'll be like low average in like 3 out of the 5 categories. But then the school psychologist in their like little analysis will say, but overall, they're average in this area.
Yeah.
We always, you know, when they're like pretty specific, we're like, no, a goal still needs to be provided for this area. And anytime I try to ask, like, how did you get average when the majority is low average? Is that something that you've kind of encountered, or do you have kind of any thoughts on the, I know it's difficult because you don't know what they're, but I was just wondering if you kind of encountered that, or you yourself like know how to get to average when a couple of the areas are low average.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. And this almost ties back to what we were just talking about in terms of the feedback sessions. You know, I work with fellows and residents. I always tell them, you know, the feedback session is the most important part of the evaluation. Because what is the point of everything we just did if parents don't understand the results? How are they going to be motivated to follow our recommendations and our treatment plan if, you know, we're not on the same page in terms of the information, right?
Yeah.
And a secondary thing that I always say is a robot should never be able to do our job, right? The robot can, you know, look at all these different test scores, label them as average, low average, impaired, whatever, and then maybe use some kind of rubric or some kind of a formula to determine if something is, if a domain is overall, you know, intact, you know, average, or if it's an area that needs support, right? That's something a robot can do, right? Or software. I'm not so techie, so I don't know what it would take. Imagine that it's possible, you know, to write a program that could do that. What a robot cannot do is consider holistically the overall patterns in the scores, understand when those scores might actually have other contributing factors, and understand, you know, how to interpret this cluster of scores that may have some variability or may demonstrate, you know, some inconsistency even within the domain. And so, yeah, I think a lot of it, you know, what I, for me, what it comes down to is, am I telling the accurate or a fair story of this child, you know? And so if I know this is a child that is struggling in a specific area, you know, maybe it's, you know, maybe it's their attention, you know, in executive functioning, and I know that they're struggling in the real world environment. I know that parents have a lot of concerns. I know it's affecting their academics, but maybe some of my scores, a lot of them are average, right? Am I just going to now say, oh, this child has no executive functioning difficulties? Or am I going to consider the fact that, you know, what does the literature say about how useful our executive functioning measures are in terms of the data compared to real world observation? Or how kind of artificial are our executive functioning measures, and how much do we actually do the executive functioning for the child in those measures versus what they're faced with in their real world environment with no support, expectations of independence.
And a very completely different environment than often testing on a one-on-one, many times in a quiet room versus in a large, loud classroom with a lot of other students. And that's the disconnect that we see a lot is the numbers say one thing on standardized measures in a very specific environment, because that's how they're normed. That's how they have to be standardized. Yeah. But that way the child operates within the classroom, within the home setting, out on the playground is completely different. And if we're not looking at the whole picture and trying to analyze, well, why is it? Is it that they have the capability of doing something, but they're not able to, you know, demonstrate it because of the setting, or is it because they need more support or X, Y, and Z? That's that missing link that I feel like rarely gets talked about.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate because it just, again, paints this unfair representation of this child, or kind of doesn't present an accurate picture. And this is where parents start getting frustrated, right? Because it's like, parents are the expert on their children. They know their child. It's kind of like, it's kind of almost like, I don't know what your numbers say, but like, I know my child is struggling. And it's, you know, so are we as evaluators helping to bridge that disconnect between what the numbers say and what the parents, you know to be a struggle for their child? So we have to make the decisions, right? Again, and this is something that I don't feel a robot should ever be able to do. We have to make the decisions on how to tie the data together to really present a narrative that fairly and accurately represents the child. And especially for an English language learner, where there are so many other confounding factors, you know, on our measures, this becomes, I think, a particular point that just doesn't get emphasized enough when we're talking about interpreting data. You know, does the data even mean anything at a certain point? If you're giving a measure, you know, that's only for, you know, I've seen, for example, I've seen, you know, young children get evaluated using the WPSI, right? And the WPSI 4, that's the common measure for preschool children. And then, okay, now it's a Spanish speaking one. And you kind of have three options. You know, you give a English WPSI, but you kind of use an interpreter and just have items administered in Spanish, or you use an English WPSI and just ignore their ability to respond in Spanish or understand items in Spanish. Or number three, there is now a WPSI in Spanish, but it's been validated in Spain, right? Which is a very different culture and language.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Mexico or, you know, Latin America. So it's kind of like you don't have really a good option either way. I would say probably the worst thing to do is to give it and, you know, not provide any credit, you know, in Spanish, and then say, and then call the child, you know, impaired intellectually, which I've seen happen. And why does that happen? It's because of the scores, right? It's because the test in what they call the most standardized way, which is, you know, no accommodation for English language learning, no interpreter, et cetera. And then you get these scores. And of course, you know, do they actually represent the child's cognitive level, or do they just represent the fact that the test wasn't accessible, you know, to the child?
Exactly right. Yeah. And I think that's like the biggest component, is that we have to understand the social construct of the culture, and literally even the culture of the classroom, right? Not just the neighborhood that the child comes from, or where their parents are from, but we find the better IEPs not only rely on the data, which we always say data, you know, is the fidelity of the data is everything. But with Andrew F., it really sheds light on the fact that there are circumstances, and whatever that might be, if the child is without a home, if the child is a foster care child, you know, if they have autism, right? Like, it does not, like, it's supposed to encompass so much more. And I think that's why your work is really important, because you are able to kind of be that kind of missing puzzle piece, because you understand the cultural impact of some of these tests, where the child may have just needed some intervention, right, that other general education students can get, or they actually need specialized academic instruction, but it needs to be provided to them in the way that they're able to access their curriculum. And I think those two things are so different, and more often than not, I don't know if it's just because it's the way that districts have done things, but they just don't take culture into account at all. And then, you know, they're either acknowledging that the child needs special education services, but they really don't. Or, you know, they do give the child special education eligibility, but then don't even provide them the right type of services and intervention. So, you know, we're so grateful that you were able to come on and kind of explain again for our listeners the impact with which a child, especially those that are learning English as a second language, and how these tests are really important for the parents to kind of pay attention to and then ask those questions, you know, and not just have the school psychologist read the report, but actually explain, well, what was your reasoning, right? Or for lack of a better term, right? Like, how did you get here? You know, my child has this, and to provide that information. Is there anything that you would like the parents to kind of have in the back of their mind as they go into the end of the assessment season for some of them?
Yeah.
Or provide your contact info again?
For sure. I think I'd like to maybe end on this, and I hope everyone's listening. I hope parents are listening, but even more so, I hope evaluators are listening. You know, the American Education Research Association actually came out with 4 major guidelines for, are we ensuring test fairness and evaluation fairness for our diverse populations? And so I just want to those 4 aspects. Number 1 is, are we maximizing comfort with the testing situation? You know, again, evaluations are such a westernized form of how we do things and how we measure things. And not mm-hmm. every culture is, you know, comfortable with such a testing environment. Mm-hmm. So are we creating an appropriate linguistic environment? Are we decreasing anxiety? Are we setting things up in a way that, you know, minimizes the interference of, you know, cultural response to testing, et cetera? You know, factor number 2 is minimizing the biases in our tests and test items, you know, understanding the limitations of Western tests and norms, understanding how some of our items, you know, even when they're translated, may not be, you know, accurate to a certain dialect or a certain culture. Factor number 3 is maximizing the accessibility of our tests. So are we ensuring mm-hmm. that they have even adequate language proficiency to, you know, mm-hmm. respond? Mm-hmm. Are we making sure we're finding either the best translation or even better, you know, a measure that's been validated in a certain sample, in a certain population and has normative data? And then finally, number 4, and I think this one is especially key, is maximizing the validity of our interpretations. Are we using the most relevant normative data? Are we considering the cultural context? Are we actually doing what we say when we say, you know, the impacts on validity have been considered, you know, and the possible, you know, impact on our scores have been considered? Are we actually considering that? And sometimes I find that I use the numbers less and more I use my clinical judgment in terms of the patterns of strengths and weaknesses. What we expect given their cultural background and their language background and how the patterns in the data might support our conclusions. That to me is more important than just looking at the numbers and whether or not they're average, low average, fair, et cetera. So those are kind of the 4 considerations for test fairness that have been established. And I hope that, you know, parents are empowered to ask those questions.
Yes.
You know, were these things considered? And I hope that examiners hear that and realize that they, you know, have a responsibility to do their due diligence. You know, we may have, you know, the WPSI example earlier, we may not always have a good option, but are mm-hmm. we using the option for the situation? You know, are we doing what we can to maximize the validity here? So just wanted to end on that point.
I love that because I think overall it kind of shows just be transparent as possible, right? I mean, we are a team. That's coming together to try to provide the correct and appropriate services for a child's unique learning style, right? So we thank you so much for your time again, Dr. Tan. And listeners, we will talk to you next week.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.